This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, South Africa's leading boutique wealth manager, trusted to guide families for over 20 years. Invest better with Brenthurst.
Stafford, a little earlier today, I was mentioning in one of the conversations is that so often when one doesn't understand something, you say, oh, it's bullshit. And that is part of the human condition. What frustrates you most about the message, the counter message that you get to this very, very strong fire and passion that you've had? You got it. You know, maybe some people will never get it in your mind, but what frustrates you most about the counter message towards the future that you see with Bitcoin?
I think I've matured. I think I'm 51 now, and I have a little bit of a different outlook. Before, if I was younger, I would be very frustrated. But in my career, I've been lucky. You know, I've been in tech since the early 90s. You know, I worked at Telkom when I came back from Israel. And when I worked at Telkom, the internet was there, but it didn't have a user interface. We built bulletin boards. I was working with people that were much smarter than me. And I was a junior guy, software developer. We were doing stuff in hardware, etc. And we were talking to people about the internet. And we said the internet was going to be big. The internet was going to be big. The internet was going to be big. And no one really believed us. And then the internet got this like graphical interface called a browser. And then suddenly people were like, the internet's going to be really big. It's going to be really big. And we were like, no, not that big. It's going to be big, but not that big. So I've seen it with the internet. I saw it with open source software when I lived in the States. When I worked for Eric Schmidt and I went to MIT. I didn't go to MIT. I visited MIT. And I went to go see what these open source software guys were all about because we were a proprietary software company. And they were making noise around open source software. And I thought, no one's going to buy software that people write for free. That's crazy. We'll do that. And then I went to MIT and I met two guys, Migrali Kaza and Nat Friedman. And from that relationship, we built Noval, bought them, and open source software is mainstream today. It's everywhere. So the internet now, everywhere. Open source software, everyone in this room with a glowing rectangle runs some form of open source software. Your iPhone is written. That tablet, the core kernel, is written by people freely for no money, for just because they want to. That's the core kernel. The cloud runs an open source software. So I've seen when people don't understand the phases that we go through until the penny finally drops. But I've been lucky because what I've learned is when people don't understand something from a technological perspective, I double and triple down on it because that's when you make your most money. You don't make your money when everyone understands it. When everyone understands it, then it's done. It's a commodity and the prices fluctuate. But when no one understands it and you triple down on it, I mean, then you make exponential money.
You know, I'm going to ask you to indulge me here. There are a lot of people here who are thinking, geez, you know, this guy's clever, but wow, what's he talking? Yeah. Eric Schmidt, your relationship with him, and who is he?
I don't really have a relationship with him. When I joined, okay, so rewind. When I went to the United States in 96, 97, he became CEO of Novell. He came from Sun Microsystems. He was the chief technology officer and he became the CEO of Novell. And he created a team underneath him called Global Corporate Technology Strategists. And essentially our role was to engage with CEOs and then translate what we were hearing there to the developers back at head office and vice versa. So it was a very unique skill set, both business and technology. So we reported into him through a guy called Lou Wagman. And then he went to Google and he offered some people to go with him to Google. And we all thought, that's a joke. I mean, one of my biggest career mistakes was saying no to go to Google back then. Because there was AOL, there was Ask Jeeves, there was all these other search engines. And like, why go to Google? Anyway, he went up, landed there. And then when I came back to South Africa in 2004, I still worked for Novell. And then when the email came through about Google, I texted someone that's still very close to Eric and said, what is this all about? Google's here. Why you want to open up an office in South Africa? And that email landed up in his mailbox, which he forwarded on to the UK. And it was one line saying, just make it happen. And I was CC'd on it. And then they flew me to London. And 18 interviews later, I left Google with a laptop and a corporate car that didn't work. And they said, go start Google. And again, that was also one of those things where when you look at the continents, as the globe, when I sat in Google's offices for the first time, they flew me up to the head office in London. When I sat there, they had this projector that projected ambiency for Google searches. So as the globe turned slowly, wherever Google searches were happening, you'd see like an ambient light, right, on aggregate. So you go over Europe, and when it came to Africa, it was completely dark. It was the only place on the earth that was completely dark. I'll never forget, I bumped into Larry, Larry Page, in the reception. And this thing was running in the reception. And he said, "Why have you been helped?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm here for an interview." He said, "Where are you from?" I said, "South Africa." He goes, "Oh." And he took me and he said, "You see that glow? See?" He said, "Go light that up. Your job is to light that up." And that was really cool. So yeah, that's when I started Google. And what people don't know is when I was at Google, we did stuff like localize the search engine, localize YouTube, you know, all that stuff, and build up the AdWords business and teach people about it. That was good. But what people didn't know was kind of the Google infrastructure side of Google, where we would go and sit down with CECOM, we'd go sit down with the submarine cables, the terrestrial fiber folks, and we'd write checks. Because what happens when people get online? They Google. And so there was a direct correlation between the investment on infrastructure, lighting people up, because it would create inventory for AdWords. So we'd literally walk around Africa making business cases work for people that couldn't make the business cases work with a deep checkbook. Yeah.
So now you know why I respect this man so much. You know his background. When he talks, listen. He's seeing the future from a perspective that most of us aren't exposed to.
But we're not giving financial advice.
So what's a Bitcoin bro?
What's a Bitcoin? Rob's a Bitcoin bro. That's the one. Yeah, Rob's been orange pilled. Warren's been orange pilled. There's a couple of folks here in the audience.
What's orange pilled?
So orange pilled is, look, this is where I must be honest, I can't really answer this. I think Bitcoin, this color orange, and Bitcoin has just become synonymous. And I need to go back because I don't think I actually know. Maybe James knows. I don't know. Wait, maybe you can Google that. Actually, yeah, you see, not many people know that. Like, why do we kind of, why is this affinity to orange? Because Michael Saylor wears an orange tie. You'll see Bitcoin is wearing orange socks. You'll see, James's hat has an orange bee. When we launched...
You've got a hat on? That's very disrespectful.
Yeah, we launched the African Bitcoin Corporation. You'll see everything's kind of orange. It's a color that we... So when we convince someone to go the Bitcoin route, it's essentially we're orange pulling them. So it's like Nemo. Remember Nemo? The red pole, the
Matrix,
the blue pole. Yeah, and so this is the orange.
Just explain the matrix and the poles. And...
No, I'm not going to do that.
Okay, so basically when you take the red pole...
Yeah, the one pole, you stay in the lie. You take the other pole, then kind of the truth's revealed, that you actually live in a pod, and this is all a simulation and all a lie, and the machine is just utilizing you for your energy. That's kind of the matrix. So it's very similar to the Bitcoin thing. You know, all of you believe the fiat world, which is a complete utter lie. It's a complete utter lie. We know that. And now you've got something truthful. So that's the thing with Bitcoin, right? What Bitcoin does that I think is so beautiful, I saw it in my children and I see it with everyone. It forces people to kind of look at the fiat system. It makes you go into the history of money. It makes you understand capital flows. It makes you go into a world that I wasn't comfortable with. When I looked at this thing for the first time in 2014, seriously, back then, I didn't understand how money worked. I didn't understand how the Fed works. I didn't understand how banking works, the fractional, all of that stuff that happens in the fiat world, didn't understand it. And when I lifted the lid on this stuff, it was quite profound. I started realizing I've been lied to. And we've all been lied to. And that's quite a thing. And that's why people that are very senior capital allocators or investment experts struggle with Bitcoin. Because Bitcoin it really tests your ego, right? Because you almost have to admit to yourself that you were wrong. And that's very, very hard for most people to do, because it is so truthful. And it exposes all the lies of what Federal Reserves do and debt and printing and all that other stuff. Yeah.
So it's quite interesting, but there's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah.
2,000 years ago, a guy called Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living. And he came to that conclusion because what he used to do every day was go down to the market and talk to people from all levels of society. And what he believed was that most people were on autopilot. And effectively, when you talk about the red pill and the blue pill, we're talking about autopilot.
Yeah.
And now what you're saying is, as far as those who've got the orange pill are concerned, they are looking beyond autopilot. They're looking at an examined life and an examined financial system. And it doesn't look very pretty. Now, I guess everybody, even the most staunch asset manager, is going to say to you, shit, I don't like what's going on with the increase in debt. And boy, this isn't going to end well. You saying there's another way of approaching it effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's happening. I think the biggest trend that's happening right now is the digitization of the TradeFi. I think that's probably the biggest
macro thing. Just explain.
That's essentially Bitcoin starting to melt up into traditional finance. So like Michael Saylor, what he's doing, right? He's got this thing that's listed and he's issuing out levered instruments that allow for capital inflows of different, you know, fixed income pools of capital. So he's going after the equity market. He's going after the bond market. He's going after money. He's opened up, you know, the Stretch that's just opened up. It's an instrument that looks and feels like a money market, but it gives you a better yield. It's a 10% interest month on month versus a money market in the United
States. Sounds like a Ponzi scheme. 10% month on month.
Yeah. Go take a look at it. Yeah, Stretch.
Phew, I need to. Yeah. I think we all need to. Yeah.
So go take a look at it. But the thing is, people, that's always the response with everyone. It's the Ponzi.
No, we've got to look at it.
You've got to look at it.
Don't ignore it. Go look at it.
Go investigate. Don't buy Bitcoin. My advice to all of you in the room, study Bitcoin. You got like really, really study it. So if you take a look at him, so that's what I mean by that. So what Michael's doing, he's creating a vortex with Bitcoin that's swallowing up more and more fiat capital that's trying to escape debasement. I mean, the Mag 7, if you take a look at their treasuries, they have enormous treasuries. And what do they do with their treasuries? Right? They keep trying to get rid of their treasuries. They keep trying to either do share buybacks, or they're going into bond markets, or they're constantly trying to do something with their capital. Why? Because that capital, if it sits still, it melts away.
Now they're investing in data. I want to ask you before
that's mergers and acquisitions.
Yeah. Before we go on to the questions, and there's a heck of a lot, as you might imagine, this data center that Google have created in South Africa, where are they getting the electricity from?
Well, they do. These data centers have special deals with Eskom, number one. Number two is they put in a lot of battery. And then they have a little bit of solar. So it's quite a mix.
But it's quite a big deal.
And generators.
For South Africa to have a data center from Google, isn't it?
Well, I think they need to. It's the amount of... I mean, coming back to when we invested in the marine fiber, when people lit up, they connected to Google. And I think, people want a better experience from their cloud computing infrastructure. So at the moment, before these data centers, we'd all have to switch up over the eastern seaboard, through the sewers, into Lisbon, all the way across there, London, and into Silicon Valley, right? That was the arterial vein. Then Wax came along and popped us all the way to the left, and then back into Lisbon in those same exchanges and back out there too. So instead of that latency, they've brought the data all the way down locally. So now your latency is less. And so they can offer you more services like cloud services, storage services. YouTube videos get cached locally now. You know, all of that stuff with Amazon's. Amazon also has a data center here, et cetera. And they co-locate. These companies work together. So they don't each create their own data center. They go into like these big Teraco data centers and they co-locate.
But my question is where they're getting their electricity from.
Well,
because
it's Eskom.
We supposedly don't have electricity.
No, we do. We have too much electricity. But I keep telling you that we don't have transmission lines to carry this stuff around. We don't have a lack of electricity, of electrons in South Africa. We have infrastructure that cannot carry it around to where it needs to go from point of generation. That's the big challenge that we have.
Okay, Stafford. John Endres from the IRR says, is there a worry about Bitcoin transaction cost and speed? Will L2 protocols solve that problem?
It's a great question. And thank you for asking that question, because people always say, yeah, Bitcoin, but it's slow. You know, it does that every 10 minutes. You have to wait for the transaction to complete every 10 minutes. And, you know, and people say that's really slow and it has a cap to it. And sometimes the transaction fees are high. Well, there's this other aspect of Bitcoin, which is layer two, which is called the Lightning layer. And that's essentially a peer-to-peer network that has peer-to-peer nodes that money flows through the nodes. And only at point of completion does it sign back into layer one. Okay. So it's like going into a bar. Simplistically put, it's like Rob and I walk into a bar. You, the barman, I give you my credit card. So you're the L1, we're the L2, right? So Rob tells the barman, put staff's drink on me. So that's an agreement that money as flows happen there. And then at the end of the night, when we walk away, what the bet that we lost, the additional drinks that we drank, the card sitting with you, when we leave at the end of the night, the reconciliation happens because we have now left. Then it's settled. So think about it that way. That's Bitcoin layer one. Then you've got Rob and I at the top, and we're playing around, exchanging, exchanging. And when we're ready to settle and reconcile, then it signs into the. And so what that happened, essentially, the transaction speeds over there is about, it's hundreds of thousands of transactions per second. It's faster than Visa and MasterCard. Now, the big challenge with those nodes was the liquidity pools inside of those nodes. So when Lightning Network first emerged, when you sent 50 rand, maybe it would reach its destination. Maybe, because it would go through James, through that node, and finally land up in Rob's wallet. But the challenge was the nodes didn't have enough liquidity. Now the Lightning Network has enough nodes with enough liquidity, and you have like a 99.999% transaction completion success. So Lightning is very real now. And then on top of that, we've got RGB. And RGB, sorry, I'm being a little bit technical, but RGB is something that works very cohesively with Lightning. So look at Lightning like the roads have been laid, RGB as people building cars. So now you're on top of Bitcoin, you can build NFTs, you can build tokens, you can build stable coins, you can do all these fancy DAOs, all these fancy Web3 things, but you can use it and put it on top of Bitcoin. And that's what USDT, Tether, the largest stablecoin.
Yeah, enough
Wait,
anagrams.
wait, wait,
Okay.
wait, wait.
Too many anagrams.
No, look,
NFTs.
the biggest stablecoin in the world is Tether.
Tether.
Okay, now Tether owns more treasuries. Well, it's in the top seven treasury owners in the world, U.S. treasuries. Okay, so they own like, it's a very big amount. It's hundreds of billions
They're
of
buying
dollars.
gold now.
They buy gold too, yes,
natural Bitcoin.
but each of their stablecoins are backed by that. Yes, and they're big U.S. But that they're Bitcoin treasury, but they don't, not like a Michael Saylor way. It's just on their balance sheet, they're building up a Bitcoin hoard, but they're not issuing out equity in a dilutive manner to get more Bitcoin. That's not their play. They just simply have Bitcoin on their balance sheet with gold, etc. But they're the largest owners, and they're of US treasuries, and they're the biggest stablecoin in the world. And they announced that they are migrating over to Bitcoin. So the biggest stablecoin in the world will inevitably run on Bitcoin as its layer one. Right now, it uses quite a few other, like Tron and some of the other L1s. Those are going to subside
Okay,
away. It's going to be Bitcoin.
I promise you've probably lost only three or four people in the audience. Stafford, let's go on.
Okay.
Rana's got a question. Is Bitcoin at 2 million rand creating a bubble, or will it appreciate even more? What do you think it'll be worth in 6 months and a year from now?
Okay, it's not investment advice. I think Bitcoin is the most undervalued asset class in the whole world.
And you've been saying that consistently.
And I've not been wrong. It's the most undervalued and misunderstood asset class in the whole world. Okay, a lot of you will look at me and I see the smirks and like, go study Bitcoin. Get the Bitcoin Standard, read the book. Get Broken Money, read the book, make up your own mind. Okay?
Join the Bitcoin WhatsApp group, premium WhatsApp group. I promise you that the information that Stafford shares there.
Oh, and James has a very
And
good
James,
company.
well, all of the guys, all the bros on the Bitcoin group. It's vibrant and there's lots of insight.
So number one, I think it's the most undervalued asset class in the whole world. I really do. And I'll give my justification for it. I also believe Bitcoin treasury companies are the most undervalued securities in the whole world. I think Michael Saylor is misunderstood. I think Michael Saylor will be in the next 36 months. This is just my personal prediction. I think it will be one of the biggest businesses in the whole world. I think he could outstrip Nvidia. If you look at Bitcoin and you price it correctly and you apply the proper FASB rules and you agree that Bitcoin is valuable and it is what it is, then I mean he climbs right up there next to Nvidia. That's how valuable he is. So I do think Bitcoin treasury companies that are run well, not all of them, those that have jurisdictional dominance and that are run well and not too levered, I think will be. Today, I think are the most undervalued companies in the whole world. I really do, because of the underlying asset class.
So, do you think that the Trump family's billions that they've been making out of Bitcoin and crypto companies is because they are understanding something that most people don't?
I think they're leveraging something in a way that I wouldn't. You know, they're issuing out their own pink coins and Melania coins and Trump coins, and I don't like that. I don't agree with that. And I think it's maybe an opportunity for me to explain that there's crypto and then there's Bitcoin. You know, when I engage with our legislators here in South Africa, when I talk to the Reserve Bank and I talk to the IFWG and I talk to FSCA and I talk to the JSC in my individual capacity, just as a person, as an advisor, because I do get pulled into the room a lot and I get people ask me the dumb questions and I like that. CEOs will pull me in and say, just, and I love doing it. And I do it on a pro bono basis. I'll come in and I'll talk to your team about Bitcoin and I'll answer the questions. And our regulators have been doing that with me probably for the last 3-4 years. And one of the things that's been very difficult, my hardest job with the regulators, is to get them to understand there's crypto and then there's Bitcoin. And the challenge is, from a regulation perspective, you have to extract Bitcoin out of crypto. Crypto is not Bitcoin. Crypto is interesting, unregulated securities attempting to do something in a computer science way with blockchains that may or may not be successful. Bitcoin is the only decentralized, sovereign, immutable, energy-bound proof-of-work protocol in the world. There's nothing else like it. It stands alone. There's only one. Everything else is speculative stuff that you can go play with. Pink coins and go play with. That's great. But if you want pure, unadulterated money, that's Bitcoin. And I've been working with the regulators to make them understand that when you regulate and you issue out regulation, you have to separate Bitcoin out, because Bitcoin is your digital commodity and regulation needs to align to that versus crypto. Because at the moment, like the JSC is talking about crypto regulation. They're like, no. You need to talk about Bitcoin regulation, then you need to talk about crypto regulation. So it is a challenge, but we've gotten them to a point right now where they've allowed us to list their Bitcoin treasury company on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, which is quite profound. It's
a huge move forward. And again, very consistent. You've said, I'm a Bitcoin maximalist. Rob's got a question for you.
Okay.
And it aligns with something that is coming increasingly now into the foreground of quantum computing.
Yes.
He says, with computing power growing exponentially, will a time arrive when a supercomputer can break the Bitcoin security and hack the Bitcoin blockchain?
Okay. So I come from, like, when I go, just, I'm going to take a long road to answer this question. When I got into Bitcoin, I was building a company called Thumbs Up. And Thumbs Up was a company that built a dongle that plugged into a phone that converted a phone into a card acceptance machine. It had never been done in ever. We did it, and then we heard of Jack Dorsey trying to do it, and that was back then. And we achieved it. We were the first in the world to do a chip and pin card-based transaction across a non-secure mobile device into a banking system securely. We did it with APSA, we did it with ANZ Bank, we went to Southeast Asia. We did all of that. When Bitcoin came along, I looked at it and I went, so, like, you know how transactions are. And here's something allowed me to convey value to someone anywhere in the world without an intermediary, more securely than we've ever done it in the history of humanity. And that, to me, was just not possible. And I struggled with that. And that was my first 2 years of Bitcoin, because I looked at payments, et cetera, and I came from it from that perspective. Now, when you build a secure device, you learn how security works in the real world. There's nothing that is completely and utterly secure. Now, I believe the Bitcoin network is the first thing that we've ever seen that's utterly and completely secure now. But when I looked at it back then, I looked at it through a security lens, where when they certify a payment device, you know that thing you put your card into? The security certification, that's called PCI. There's PCI SRED, PED. There's different iterations of it. But essentially is, they're working it this way. When they test your device, you built a castle, then you dug a hole, then you poured water, then you put crocodiles in the water. Then you put barbed wire all the way around there. Then you put a soldier on the wall, da, 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 da. So they're not interested in that you built a solid wall that's impenetrable. They're interested in knowing that when the guy came over the fence, you can detect him. Then there's crocodiles. Then there's the barbed wire, then there's that. So defense mechanisms have this like thing that cascades up. Now, if you have a quantum computer is this thing that has the capability to take cryptographic puzzles and solve them kind of like instantaneously and crack the code and gain access to all the keys, because it's got the brute force power, because it's a quantum computer. in terms of its execution. I'm keeping it real simple now. Now, the worry is if we build a quantum computer will have the ability to attack the Bitcoin network. Now, man, this quantum computer will have to have very different characteristics to the quantum computers that I've seen. Because to do a 51% attack on the Bitcoin network with a quantum computer, there isn't one yet built that can do that. And a 51% attack means you must have the capability to take 51% of the computing power that mines the transactions and assume responsibility for that and then take over the protocol. Can't do that with Bitcoin. That's what's so difficult to hack Bitcoin. So, number one, I don't think it's a threat. Number two is when it does become a threat, I don't think Bitcoin's going to be the issue. I think it's going to be your four-digit bank PIN. It's not going to be that long, long little alphanumeric number that's your wallet address. It's not going to be that. Look at your look at your bank. You're going to be real worried if someone has a quantum computer. But if someone did have a quantum computer, you always have to take a look at it. If they did do the hack, what would be the energy footprint? Could we find them, etc.? So in the security world, they look at the tools that you need to do the hack, the skills that you need to do the hack, the time to take to do the hack, etc. All of that combines into your security profile. If you have a quantum computer, you fail immediately. Why? It's bloody big. Its energy signature is huge. The skill set to run it is incredible. So if you did hack, we know where to come find our coins. We're going to fly planes and we're going to bomb the hell out of you, etc. Right? So that's the one. But the other side is, if you build a quantum computer, we will probably fork, technology speaking, we could fork Bitcoin and we could create a branch and create a whole new chain that has quantum cryptography built inside of it. And we could easily do that. We've done it. If you go back all the way to Bitcoin's first instantiation, go read the block size wars and all of those books, you'll see we've done this. You know, where we forked Bitcoin and we chose, Bitcoin has forked. Bitcoin's not static. There's developers that work on Bitcoin all the time. It's just consensus-driven change. So yeah, quantum computer, interesting. Makes people go, ooh, they don't understand Bitcoin, and sometimes affects the Bitcoin price, but it's not a real threat. It really, really isn't.
Rob's follow-up, and that's not the right. We've got 6 minutes to go. He says, did you sell your Range Rover to buy Bitcoin?
You're not supposed to know that. Yeah. Oh, you're not supposed to disclose that. Yeah, so I mean, I think Warren knows this. I'm probably the poorest guy in this room. I don't own things. I really don't. I had 9 properties. I sold them all and bought Bitcoin over a year. I had an apartment in Melbourne. I had an apartment in Brooklyn. I had a farm in the Midlands. I had my wife's house in Durban. I had a house in some BT. We had a house in Bryanston. I sold them all and I bought Bitcoin. My car,
what was the differentiation between, or the difference between had you kept them and today?
Oh, that's going to disclose a lot, which I don't want to disclose. But when
did you sell?
So, no, here's the point. The point is, if I'd kept them, if I'd sold them today, I would have at best broken even on those properties. You know, simply because of, if I take a look at rates, maintenance, it wasn't worthwhile. And then my carbon footprint was much bigger and it was a waste. It was access. It was a waste. And I shouldn't have had that. And today my carbon footprint's smaller and I feel more good about it. And I feel more sovereign and I can, if Cyril does anything with Trump and I don't like it, I can get in the car and leave with everything in my head. And I think that's very, very powerful. So, I mean, it's just the power of that it's quite exhilarating. And when you start kicking, and yes, Rob knows about this. I looked at my Range Rover and I was like, why do I own this thing? It's stupid. I don't want a Range Rover anymore. And I drove it and a guy bought it and I walked away and I literally just bought Bitcoin with it. Yeah.
I mentioned this earlier at a little session that I was invited to by our partners at Financial Times in Davos 2 years ago. Neil Ferguson was the person talking there. And he said, if I lived in a turbulent country, I'd have a high percentage of my assets in Bitcoin, which was very interesting because he's the man who wrote The Ascent of Money. If anybody knows the history of money, Ferguson knows it. What percentage of your assets would you have in a country like South Africa when you put it in the turbulent index?
Again, it's not investment advice. Okay, but I do think South Africans, it is irresponsible for you not to understand this asset class. It's irresponsible. If you understand what's happening around you, I mean, I think I say the same things, kind of what Magnus says in terms of South Africa, in terms of diversifying out and all of that. My difference is this: I diversify into Bitcoin. You know that, and take a look at some of, you know, if you want to diversify in the Bitcoin world, look at some of the treasury companies. That's an interesting one. So Bitcoin, to hold Bitcoin, you wanna leave a Bitcoin. You wanna outperform Bitcoin. Diversify a little bit into like MicroStrategy's instrumentation. You know, maybe some of our shares that we will issue out relative to it, because we're gonna try and outperform Bitcoin. But yeah, that would, I mean, he knows it. Niall Ferguson knows it. Larry Fink knows it. You keep going to the big names now. They all understand that the 60-40 portfolio doesn't work anymore. That what because of AI longevity, we now need to go, and I said it, I think the portfolio now needs to be 57-43.
Rainer Aubrey asks a similar question here with a different spin, though. What's the biggest risk, in your opinion, of holding a large Bitcoin or crypto portfolio?
You lose your keys.
Explain that.
So with Bitcoin, you have the ability to take your keys off an exchange and have it,
Your password, in other words.
your password to your key. Let's keep it like that. And like a Simple B and James and them have solutions where you can put it on a stick, you can, you know, passphrases that you can write down. There's ways to protect it where you have like a multi-signature ceremony aspect to it. I think the biggest change is yourself. You really need to understand and educate yourself, not just about Bitcoin. Once you get that, is work with people like James. James has done a very good job, and I'm marketing now, because I actually put all everyone that asks me, okay, I've got 1 million rand of Bitcoin now on Luno, what do I do with it? I always give James's number.
The CEO of Luno is also in the audience.
Okay, good. I always say go talk to James, because I don't think it should be on exchange. And I think Luno will say the thing that they don't like people to hold their Bitcoin on the exchange. They would advise you too as an exchange. I know Fazam from Valor. And educate yourself around personal custody of your Bitcoin. Understand what all the options are, the sticks, putting it on pieces of metal and imprinting it, passphrases. Understand the risks associated with that. It's very liberating. It's extremely powerful, but you lose it and you lose it. And that's why there's a big percentage of Bitcoin that's lost Bitcoin, that's irrecoverable, because people either lost their keys, the passcodes, or they've, you know, lost the device that had it on it. We've heard stories like that. And that Bitcoin is never coming back, ever. Ever, ever. It's gone forever. Yeah, so educate yourself on that side of it.
My friend bought 200 Bitcoin. Well, he bought the CFDs, so I don't know if it actually means the same thing. In 2014, for 200,000 rand, I calculated it was worth $14 million, and he doesn't know where it's gone. So that's the final question.
It's crazy.
Yuck. For a private investor into Bitcoin, what are the tax implications, from Keith Wetmore?
Well, I mean, right now, SARS looks at it as capital gains. So, you know, every time you touch it, do something with it, it's a CGT event. The challenge with our legislators, though, in South Africa, is that they, maybe I shouldn't disclose too much about this, but they don't. Wait, no,
Don't disclose it.
No,
no, no. This will go out to many people, and rather.
Okay, no,
but
rather.
the point of it is, if you're buying Bitcoin and you're trading, that's like trading anything. But if you're buying it and you're adding to your wealth, then you won't have a tax event, because
No,
you keep
you
building.
accumulate. You keep, the day you touch it, that's when the CGT event. Okay.
Stafford,
Okay.
it's always a privilege talking
Okay.
to you, and thank you for sharing.
Welcome. Thank you.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth. Building wealth and protecting legacy since 2004. Invest better with Brenthurst.